Hello, everybody. Here we go. Scott Burnside back again for Two Man Advantage, the podcast. Pierre LeBrun. Pierre, I'm really looking forward to today. I always look forward to chatting with you, but we're going to hear from Deputy Commissioner Bill Daley in the second segment, and we're going to talk a bunch of stuff, but I was curious, because your kids are smaller now, and next week is Halloween. Have you got costumes picked out? Are you ready to roll? Is Halloween a big deal in the LeBrun household? Is that where does that fit in?
It is a big deal, but as you know, we're doing a 2-year reno in our house, and only have access to half our house right now. And in fact, our entire property has been framed out. The construction company puts this gigantic fence around the house. While imploding half of our house, and so we're not going to have other kids walk into that disaster. So I think the last I heard from my 9-year-old daughter Melanie is, I think we'll set up just like a lemonade stand. We'll set up a Halloween stand outside the fortress, and make sure that we take care of trick or treaters in the neighborhood. But in the meantime, I'm trying to remember my son. Who's a meathead, Mark? I think he's going to be a ninja.
Okay.
Yeah, a ninja. And I think my two daughters were still debating between a couple of costumes.
Last I checked. Well, you see, you're nicer than I am, because if I had hoarding around my entire house so that it looked like a demolition site, then I would take advantage of that not to give out any candy. So you're obviously way nicer than I am. Did you ever dress up as a hockey player? Because when I think of Halloween, my first, and we lived in Northern Ontario. It's funny, this came up in a conversation with Dale Talon, the GM of the Florida Panthers. I spent some time with he and Chris Pronger the last few days. We were in New York, and he's from Northern Ontario as well, Cochrane area, Rouyn Noranda.
Hold on. This just shows you what a southerner you are. He's from Rouyn-Noranda is from Quebec, buddy.
Okay, it's right on the border.
It is on Quebec-Ontario border.
Okay, yes. Yeah, that's right. Well, we lived in Northern Ontario. You could see the lights of Ville-Marie, Quebec, and I remember growing up, and that seemed like an exotic thing. But some of my first Halloween memories are actually dressing up as a hockey player. Before I could learn to skate, we had the old wooden stick and the plastic CCM helmet, and there are pictures of me. And I think it might have been the first Halloween costume for more than 1 year. Like, we didn't have a lot of money, so I think we used the same costume. We repeat it over the years. And did you ever dress up as a hockey player?
Oh yeah, I'd put the old bucket on for sure. Star Wars characters for sure in the 80s.
Yeah.
But you know, where I grew up in Hearst, which is actually Northern Ontario, which is near Cochrane, by the way.
Okay.
We would usually get our first major snowstorm around Halloween. That's how far north it is that where I grew up. I don't know if it's the same today with climate change and everything else. I don't get up to Hearst much anymore, but it was mighty cold. So you had to be quite, my parents had to be smart about finding a costume where I could also wear a full ski suit underneath it, so that I didn't freeze to death while getting candy.
That's true. Yeah, we had the same thing. I think some of the first pictures, we have like a heavy sweater on, like not a jersey, like a hockey jersey. We didn't have any of those, but yeah, you had to wear a sweater, and plus your costume had to go over the heavy sweater stuff. So that's very good. What else? Okay, before we go out, what are you a scary movie guy? Like, I can't remember. Are you? Do you like them? Are you?
Well, let's see. How many films have we watched together, buddy, over the years? You know, we've gone to the movie theater together on the road, have we not?
No, never. I have never been to a theater with you. That's why I ask. I know you like Peaky Blinders, but no, I have never been to a theater with you. I can say that with relative certainty.
They don't serve red wine there.
No, they don't. Although it's some now in the high-end movie theaters, at least in the States, maybe it's different. But you can get a beer or a glass of wine if you so desire. But I can't even recall the last time I was in a theater. But anyway, so are you a scary movie guy?
No, not really. I don't have much time for that. I like dramas, and I'm a very sensitive soul, as you know.
That's it. Yes. Well, I'm sure you've seen A Star Is Born then, so that's good. Well, good for you. All right. Well, let's move on. And speaking of a star, I don't know whether he's a star or not. But I thought it was interesting, your piece that came out actually earlier today. Or is it going to run tomorrow? Maybe I don't know.
It's going to run on Friday, yes.
Okay, yeah. But okay, interesting development with the Golden Knights locking up Nate Schmidt to a long-term deal and extending him. And it really is, I think it's interesting on a couple of fronts. And I'm not surprised. Nate Schmidt's an important part of the Golden Knights. And, you know, it's a team that is, I think, slowly starting to find its traction after a very difficult start. Now they're coming off an overtime or shootout loss to Vancouver. Very surprising. Vancouver Canucks team, but you know, one of the reasons I think that they haven't got off to the start that people assume they might is the absence of Nate Schmidt, who serves, of course, serving a 20-game suspension for running afoul of the league's performance-enhancing drugs rule. And but now extending him, even though he hasn't played a single game and won't for quite some time yet, I think it shows you how important he is to them specifically, but I think it also speaks to, you know, what is a very thin defensive market. You tell me if you think I'm wrong, but, you know, as you look ahead to free agency next summer, players that might be available at the trade deadline, all those kinds of things, it's a thin group, and George McPhee likes to take care of business, and he's done it early in locking up Nate Schmidt.
Yeah, well, first of all, let's deal with Vegas, Scott. As usual, you asked me 17 questions.
It's really more a bunch of statements. I don't even know if there was a question in there. But anyway, there were some statements, and you can choose to respond to them or not.
Yeah. I paid attention the whole time, though, this time. So that's good. you know, but on Vegas, first of all, a clear trend from the Golden Knights. They continue to opt for long-term when they can and re-signing their guys. If you go back to last year, you know, Jonathan Marchesso signed a long-term deal. You know, so did, you know, Colin Miller, Brendan McNabb, same, you know, Max Pacioretty signs an extension.
Yep.
Yeah, if he doesn't sign the extension, Vegas doesn't make the trade. But certainly this year, Shea Theodore, Alex Tuch, and now Nate Schmidt, all long-term deals. And in the case of Theodore, that was a big deal. That was a bone of contention because, you know, Theodore and his camp for the longest time fought for a two-year bridge deal because they obviously felt that, you know, they could use the 2 years to continue to beef up his pedigree and then come back for more in 2 years, which is, by the way, what I think most guys going into their second contract should do. But Vegas fought long and hard and upped the ante, upped the AAV, and ended up on a long-term deal both sides could live with. What's happening, and I asked George McPhee about this after the Theodore signing, but it obviously applies to the Tuch signing, which was 7 years, and to the Nate Schmidt signing, which was 6 years. McPhee said at the time after the Theodore signing to me, said, you know, the salary cap right now for them is like a perishable commodity. Like, they're not going to have it forever, the cap space that they have. They have more cap space than most teams. And I think they bet on the fact that let's get all these guys on long-term deals. Yes, it's a gamble because if they don't end up being as good as what they're, you know, as what they're portraying them to be long-term, then they'll regret it. But, you know, at the end of the day, for sure, Shea Theodore, by the end of his deal at 5.2, that'll be a bargain for a number one defenseman. I think Nate Schmidt would have got more than $5.95 million a year in the open market this summer, for sure. Now, mind you, again, the old lack of state income tax in Nevada playing a major card here, right? I mean,
sure, yeah.
$5.95 in Las Vegas, you know, I mean, that's basically like $7 million a year in California or New York or any of the Canadian teams. So that was a major factor. So certainly, like I said, the big trend for Vegas is they want to use their cap space now and lock in their key guys long term. As for the impact on the market, man, I mean, that's my piece on Friday. But, you know, a year ago, we had this dream of Drew Doughty, Ekman, Larson, you know, Ryan McDonough, Nate Schmidt, Ryan Ellis. All these guys are going to go to free agency in 2019. Well, not so much. They've all signed. They all signed ahead of time. And it leaves us basically with Erik Karlsson, who we'll see what he does with San Jose. And if Karlsson goes to market, that's a huge deal, but we'll see. And then, you know, Jay Gardner and Tyler Myers, who are both terrific players in their prime. But after that, it really starts to thin out.
Yeah, that changes how – well, and I mean, maybe this is just – this is just the way of the future for – the NHL, right? I mean, look, there, I mean, John Tavares as a forward was an outlier, I think, and you know, because we, you know, how many times did we talk about Steven Stamkos and he might go to market and what it would mean to the marketplace, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, it didn't happen. He ends up staying in Tampa.
Hold on. Technically, I guess if you look back at history and we're marking it down, I guess Stamkos did tip his toes because he spoke to other teams.
Right. He did go to market. Right. But he went to market briefly and then stayed. I guess my point is when someone like Tavares who comes to the marketplace and looks around and actually then moves on, he becomes someone who makes a choice and moves on. And I just think those kinds of players and that kind of dynamic will become so rare now. And you're right. Maybe Erik Karlsson, whatever happens in San Jose the rest of the season, and you wrote brilliantly that he can't extend there until, tell me the date.
He can't extend for 8 years until after the trade deadline.
Right.
Exactly. But if, you know, obviously if he wanted to sign for seven or less, he could do it today. But
he could do it anytime. Right. Yeah.
But I can't imagine.
Maximum 8 years.
Yeah.
But so he's, you know, I mean, anyone's guess, I suppose, at this point, whether he goes or stays. So obviously a lot of will depend on his own feelings on, you know, his comfort level in San Jose and where the team is at. But, you know, isn't this just the way of the future, that teams are going to be so focused on locking down players that they believe important to their future and that, you know, those core players, because you know the player and maybe you know, you're not spending any more money, right? I mean, it's funny, Dale Talon and I were just sort of chatting, you know, when do you overspend? You overspend on July 1st. Yeah. And if you can do it before then why wouldn't you do it? And then let me ask this question. Doesn't that put more pressure on teams to focus and spend money and commitment to drafting, developing, making sure the players that you have under your own umbrella become the kind of players that you want to have around for 6 or 8 or 10 years?
No question. And it's also why teams are so aggressive about trying to lock up RFAs to long-term deals so that they don't even have this UFA predicament, right? I mean, so the industry has changed so much. It used to be that players had to work their way up to finally in their late 20s, early 30s, making money. Now they're making money right out of their entry-level deal in their second contract. So the game has changed a lot that way. But, you know, I I'm with you. I think that Tavares represented, you know, breaking away from the norm. I mean, hockey players, it's just so fascinating compared to other sports. But, you know, all things being equal, they'd rather stay put for the most part. It's very interesting. I mean, they leave when they're told that that teams can't afford them or that they're rebuilding, you know, like different circumstances like that. But normally they stay. But we'll see. There are still some big names that are pending UFAs. I mean, you think of, you know, Artemi Panarin, who would be the top offensive option on the market. And he has indicated that he is not only not re-signing with Columbus, but, or I shouldn't say he's indicated this. He hasn't said this publicly, but we believe this to be the case, that he's told the Jackets he's not signing with them, but I don't think he's signing with anyone before the end of the year. I think that even if he's traded, I think he wants to hit the open market. You know, his teammate Sergei Bobrovsky would be certainly a rare commodity for a Vezina Trophy type guy to be on the market under the age of 30, although he's 29. But still, that's pretty rare if he ends up on the market. Mark Stone is 26 years old. I mean, a first-line, legit offensive threat. And, you know, Ottawa's going to do everything they can between now and July 1st to sign him, but he could be on the market. You know, we know Erik Karlsson's number one, but Matt Duchene, 27, he has to make up his mind. Wayne Simmonds, whom I wrote about this week, the Flyers have to figure out what they're going to do there. So there are guys, but to your point, it'll be fascinating to see how many actually end up there July 1st.
Right, yeah, because the list now, and it's been, you know, Craig Custins had put out the list last week. I think it was the top 25, and it's you're right. It is educational, and it illustrates your point. If we're having this chat, you know, come trade deadline time, how many of those guys are still, still available. That will be interesting. I'm curious, the other thing that's come up when you talk about these, you know, the contracts that young players, you know, they get the longer term, the bigger dollar earlier. And I'm sure you hear this too from GMs and coaches, that sometimes, you know, that there is this feeling that young players have been paid so early in their careers that it may affect their development, that they get, so they've, you know, back in the day, you worked, and when you finally got to free agency, even though you might have passed your peak as a performing player, whether you're a goaltender, or a defenseman, or forward, that in some ways you were getting paid for what you had done, not necessarily what you could do over the next 4 or 5 years. But it was almost like a reward, right? When you got to free agency, you were rewarded for all that work. And I have heard I've heard lots of people talk about this, like, you know what, what's the old saying, it's hard to eat when you're full, or, you know, like the notion that you've been rewarded with this big contract and this money at a young age, does it blunt your incentive to continue to develop and to become, you know, or maximize your potential, all those kinds of things? And, you know, hockey players are in general competitive group, like who wouldn't want to get better? But I wonder if you hear the same kind of thing, that this is sort of the byproduct of having these deals where younger players are locked down early for longer term and for big dollars based on their potential to produce as opposed to what they've done. And that's the narrow line that a GM has to walk, right? Like, what do you find the same thing? Have you heard the same kind of, geez, you know, there's a kid who got all this money in this term, and, you know, his evolution has flatlined, or that he isn't progressing the way that they'd imagined when they gave him the deal?
It's for sure. It's a concern. First of all, they have no choice. I mean, that's just the way, like I said, the system is set up now, where you're having to make early decisions on young core guys before you've seen more of them that you would have liked to before having to do that. But the reason that teams are having to do this is because they're trying to fight the third contract, right? So if you can get a player, like, you know, let's take Shea Theodore as an example.
For sure. I mean,
Vegas gave him a 7-year extension, and he basically just has 1 year plus under his belt as a full-time NHLer, you know, like half a year in Anaheim and a full year in Vegas. And now they've made a call on him on 7 years. I think they made the right call, but the reality is, in the previous CBA, I think that's a player that probably takes a 2 or 3 year deal and then they can get to him again. But the way it's set up now, teams are so scared, I think, of what it's going to cost them if they went too short on the second contract, that they're trying to make, they're basically gambling and trying to predict and project what these guys are before they truly know. And so one, that's added a lot more risk into it with young players than you used to have. And you're right, obviously the human factor, which is, once you've given a 23-year-old player an 8-year deal, how is he going to react? And players are different. Sidney Crosby could have a 74-year contract and you would not know, right? You just wouldn't know. I mean that's the self-drive, the greatest self-drive in the game, just the way that he motivates himself. It doesn't matter what his contract is. And then you have guys that whose play has tailed off, I think, in terms of their hunger after getting that type of deal. So you have to make sure, no question about it.
Yeah, you know, I was in Dallas last week and was doing a number of different things, and including one of the things, I haven't written this yet, so I'm going to, just in case Sarah, our boss, is listening, I am going to do this. But so I had dinner with John Klingberg as part of this thing, where I spent some time either having a player cook dinner, or we go and have lunch or dinner or whatever. So John Klingberg and I were out. It was the first time we've done it. And he's very self-aware, very smart. And he was one of those players that early on signed a deal. I'm just looking at it now. I think it extends through 21-22. And I believe the cap hit is $4.25 million, which is
cheap.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, but but we were having this discussion, and I'd have to go back and look at my notes. But when he signed this deal, I think it was like a total of 90 NHL games that he played, or something like that. And we were just talking about this very dynamic, like, that to have that security for him was really important, right? He, because it was not a straight line for John Klingberg. Worked really hard, went back to Sweden to play a year, even when the Stars wanted to come and play in Texas in the American Hockey League. He's such a fascinating guy because he is going to be in the Norris Trophy discussion. He certainly, offensively, is going to be one of the top offensive producers among defensemen in the NHL and maybe for the foreseeable future.
For sure.
We were talking about, and you did a great story earlier, Ryan Ellis, who had similar kind of track. They're different kinds of players, but, you know, Ryan signed a deal earlier in his career that, you know, when it expired at the end of last year, you know, it was below.
It's still going.
Right.
He's playing out the final year, but $2.5 million.
Right. And you wrote eloquently about the extension in the process with the Nashville Predators. But it is interesting, you know, that was to have the security for John Klingberg was really important to him. And it's clearly he is a player who aspires to lots, right? Like, he wants to be a leader. He wants to be better. But it isn't, you know, people forget, I think, a lot of the dynamics, especially with young players. And you want security. You want to know what's going to happen to you and your family and all those kinds of things. But you also want to be paid where the market is. I think it takes a strong person. Like, you would never have known from the way Ryan Ellis played that he was making a fraction of what his value was at the end of that contract, right? Guy plays at an exceptionally high level. But I think those are the things we sometimes forget when we think about the game, is that there's a lot of decisions that go into it from the player side too. You're rolling, you know, you're betting on yourself or whatever you're doing. And Panarin's an interesting example, as you mentioned. You know, he's at a point in his game where if he follows through on this plan we believe he's following, that he will go to market. We'll see. Sometimes, and then we'll see whether it works out or not. But I just think it is interesting when you sort of start talking about the factors that go into whether you sign a deal or not, and the situation is very fluid. So,
mm-hmm. No, it's and in John Klingberg's case, going back to the story that you're going to write here, but you know, Dallas clearly believed in what they saw in a very short period of time, that they wanted to get ahead of this, that they thought Klingberg in a very short time would become among the league leaders among offensive defensemen and wanted to secure his services long term before that was self-evident. And I know people always look back and say, well, geez, like, why would he sign that? But, you know, when people throw money at you, even if it's less than we should be making today, you throw money at a guy who's barely played a year, there's a lot of security that comes with that. And it's hard to resist, I think, if you're a player. You know, I mean, you know, I think, you know, Mark Scheifele making $6.125 million. Like, that's just theft right now from Winnipeg. Yep. And Nathan MacKinnon at $6.3 million when he should be making $10 million. But he signed it after a couple of, you know, a tough sophomore year and a tough third year. And it's like, geez, what's going on? Well, since then, he's never looked back. You know, that's the gamble each side takes. And I think more and more teams are willing to take that gamble because I think, you know, if you can pat more than 500 on these, it'll really help your cap management.
Yeah, no, there's no question. And Tavares is a great example. A very team-friendly contract to finish out his term with the New York Islanders. And, well, he's making almost twice. Right. If I'd have to go back and look, but I believe he's making around twice the amount of what he was making on his last year with the New York Islanders. And I'm sure there isn't anybody in Toronto, you know, having watched an absolutely fantastic hockey game this week between Winnipeg and Toronto. I'm sure no one is batting an eye, but, you know, that's. He waited and he had to bide his time before he got that kind of payday. And that's right. How it turned out for him.
But you don't always nail it. Like, I think the Leafs right now are still wondering, you know, they had barely had Zaitsev for a year after bringing him over from Russia as a UFA. And they put a 7-year extension in front of him, if you remember. Yeah. And last year, in his second year, he really struggled. It's $4.5 million a year over 7 years. It's not a huge number, but it's still, You know, it's still 7 years and 31.5 million offered to a guy in May 2017 that they had for 8 months. Yeah. And you know, I got to say, there are nights where it looks like he'll live up to that 4.5, and other nights where he doesn't. So there's certainly risk.
Yeah, well, and you're right. I mean, and really, it is about, you know, it's like a batting average, right? I mean, if you can bat 500 on those, then you're right. You should be okay. You can't swing and miss though, right? You can't go 0-4, right? You can't miss those. So I want to, you know, we're going to get towards the end of the first segment here of Two Man Advantage. We're going to hear from Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly in the second half. What else is on your mind? I mentioned the Vancouver Canucks in passing, continuing in spite of crippling injuries. They might be for me the we're not quite at the end of the first month, but we're edging towards the end of the first month of the regular season. That might be the most surprising team to me, because I just really thought the Travis Green's lineup was just going to be, it was just going to be really hard, and yet they are. I get so much enjoyment out of watching that team, you know, on a nightly basis, do things that on paper they don't look like they should be able to. And I wonder, is there a team or is there a player you're looking at and you go, yeah, you know what, that's cool, that's a great story, whether it lasts a month or 6 weeks or maybe it carries into the second half of the season. But is there something that I'm just looking at this while I was biding time there? They're 6-4. They're in first place in the Pacific Division right now, the Vancouver Canucks, as we tape this. That's pretty darn good.
Yeah, I mean, one of the huge surprises for sure. I think most people had them pegged for, you know, being in the bottom five of the overall NHL standings. I mean, listen, they're a young team. They're rebuilding. It's the post-Sedins era. And not to mention, you know, they beat Vegas last night. They've been doing this without Elias Pettersson, who after a remarkable start, of course, had the concussion, and he's on the mend now. But, you know, to do that even without the Calder Trophy frontrunner is unbelievable. And regardless of where things end up, and I do think they'll level off, Scotty, to answer your question.
For sure.
I wasn't ignoring you.
No, but it wasn't even really a question, I don't know.
Yeah,
but anyway.
but, you know, what you're trying to do, if you're Vancouver or Ottawa or Montreal, all the teams that people have picked to miss the playoffs, is that regardless of how the season ends, whether you're in or out, that you've established that things have changed, that what was acceptable last year is not acceptable. You know, throw Buffalo in there, because I've seen a noticeable change in their body language and the way they approach things so far this year than the past few years. And I think you're seeing that with Travis Green and the Canucks, that there's a real turning of the page there. They're going to miss the playoffs, I think, but at the end of it, if there's still the same pace to their game and the youth and exuberance and the way they do things now, then I think Canucks fans can live with that, because they know the best is yet to come. You know, I think the Senators have overachieved. They're so, so young, especially on the back end. I think there'll be a leveling off there. But again, you know, it's the post-Carlson era, and they're super young and might get even younger. Again, if it's the sense that at least, you know, they're doing this with enthusiasm and there's a plan, then I think Senators fans, believe it or not, given how bleak things were all summer, actually have something to hang on there to. You know, I think the Habs, it's a little different, Scott. It's not as shocking to me that the Canadiens are where they are. You know, again, they won the division 2 years ago with the Atlantic Division. So, yeah. I mean, Carey Price is still there. Shea Weber's coming back in December. But, you know, they looked a lot different than last year's team. Way more pace, up-tempo, spending way less time in their zone. They're getting offense from their top three lines, which is something for that team, because they really could not score last year. Jonathan Drouin looks like a new man this year. He really looks dynamic. This is the guy that they traded for and didn't see much of last year when he was trying to play center. Now he's back on the wing, and I think it's been a good, you know, a good shift for him. So some good surprises, but of all those teams that you're talking about, I think the Habs have the chance to have the most sustainability in terms of hanging into a wild card race.
As we speak, just one regulation loss. That's pretty impressive. And that's the, you know, that's the key for, for, well, it's key for all teams, but certainly the key for teams that are trying to maybe reverse the flow, to go against the trend, and that is to put points in your pocket, right? I mean, you can, you know, whether it's, yeah, you know, and the Habs have done that, 5-1-2 in their first eight games, so good for them. What else? Anything else? Because we're going to close this segment, but I have one. I came across this thing, but I want to ask you just. I don't want to cut you off. There's something you want to touch on before we move on.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, with the Leafs beating the Jets last night, now they're going to play again Saturday night.
Yep.
But what, I mean, if you're going to handicap the top five right now, have you changed your mind from before the season started, or it's still the same five teams?
In the league?
Oh, yeah, like the five best bets to win the cup in your mind.
I think, you know, I will tell you the team, and it was funny, I was watching, of course, being Canada, I was watching NBC Sports Network and not the Sportsnet feed on the doubleheader last night, and I watched most of both games. So first of all, it was the Winnipeg-Toronto game, which was terrific, and really, you know, to me, it showed the maturity of the Leafs, because the Jets really brought it in the third period, made it 3-2, had a power play. It was, I thought, oh my goodness, the Jets are going to do what they did to the Blues earlier in the week, which was to storm back and erase a 3-goal deficit. But the Leafs got a big goal from John Tavares and went on to victory. But the second game, which might have even been better, was Tampa, mm-hmm. Colorado. And you know, everyone, you know, we all thought Tampa was going to be there. I would, if we went back and looked, my guess is that they would be the favorite among favorites to win a Stanley Cup, and certainly to come out of the East. But Colorado for me is a team that I don't know whether they can sustain it. I'm not sure of their depth. They rely so heavily on that top line with Nathan MacKinnon and Rantanen and Gabriel Landeskog, who actually scored, but then they overturned it on an offside challenge, which was brilliant by the Tampa Bay Lightning. But the Avs are interesting to me because they play such a lightning fast game, and you hope they stick around. So I'm not saying that you win it, but they're a team that I now am much more cognizant of. And actually, Pierre Maguire suggests this out loud, and I was like, really? It's a little bit early. But he said, this could be a Stanley Cup final preview. Now, I think that's probably a bit much, given how deep the West is. But I think Colorado is, they're not going anywhere. Like, I think they're a playoff team, and I think it's going to be fun to see, you know, if they can take another step, and could they challenge a team like Nashville?
Now, be careful. Lars Eller called the Leafs a mere playoff team and got in trouble. I need you to be careful that you only called Colorado a playoff team. No, I'm with you, and I think what's interesting about it is that I think the Avs needed this kind of start for themselves. Yes. Never mind what people like us and people in the outside world think. That's immaterial. But for them in their dressing room, I think having this kind of opening month sort of fortifies the confidence that they brought over from last year. That last year wasn't an overreach. Yeah. That the journey, that this incredible turnaround that they had last year, you know, is not going to just vaporize. That in fact, they are on their way. And so, listen, I do think there'll be some tough times ahead. I'm with you. I don't know where they get goals when the top dogs don't score. It's kind of like Dallas that way. But, you know, I love what I see from their blue line. They've got a terrific 1-2 punch and goal. Jared Bednar is an excellent forward-thinking coach. I think the Avs are a playoff team. And what makes it interesting to me is that, you know, the Central Division, which is the best in hockey, we always talk about, well, it's Winnipeg and Nashville, and then there's a lot of good teams after that. Well, I don't know. I mean, is Colorado going to stay in that first-place race with the Jets and the Predators? Could be awfully interesting.
Well, as you know, as a Western guy now, sort of, right, formerly with Dallas, so I feel like a Western guy. Do you think the Central is still better? Is the Central better than the Atlantic? And I ask that because you've got, right, Toronto playing, you know, they're 7-3, undefeated on the road, 5-0 on the road, pretty unbelievable. Tampa is Tampa. They're what we thought they were going to be. We've already talked about Montreal, the surprise there. Boston is a good, solid team. Florida, now, probably one of the most disappointing starts in the Atlantic mm-hmm. Division, but they, I think they are going to get it. They're, you know, they miss Roberto Luongo. It's taken them a while, but, you know, when I look at those, especially, you know, the top, you know, those are high-end teams, right? When you're talking Toronto, Tampa, throw Montreal and Boston in that group, like that's it. You know, doesn't leave a lot of room if you're a Metropolitan Division team thinking, well, if we get five teams going to the playoffs, maybe we can sneak into the second wild card spot. Well, you know, there's not going to be that much room. And so I'll ask it then: do you think that the Central is that much further ahead of the Atlantic right now?
I don't know about that much further ahead, but I do think the Central is still the best division. I think if you put the seven Central division teams in a wrestling cage match with the eight Atlantic division teams, I just saw the documentary on Andre the Giant, and I thought it was awesome. So,
okay,
I somehow got into wrestling there, but I think the difference is that, you know, in the Atlantic, Boston, Tampa Bay, and Toronto are legitimate Stanley Cup elite threats. But I think it's top heavy. I mean, the Habs are surprising. Florida should be better. You know, Ottawa's surprising. Buffalo's taking a step this year. But at the end of the day, there's only three teams in the Atlantic that truly have a shot to go deep in the playoffs, in my mind. Whereas I think in the Central, I mean, heck, St. Louis is sitting last in the Central as we tape this. Are they not a team that, if everything goes well, could be a pretty good playoff team? I think so.
Yeah,
well, you know, the Stars, I mean, the Wild are the team that I thought would really take a step backwards this year, but they're hanging in. Chicago's had a nice bounce back. And, of course, we talked about the big three of Nashville, Winnipeg, Colorado. So I think no division in hockey has the totality and depth talent-wise than the Central Division.
Very good. Well said. All right, why don't we do this? Let's take a break. We'll come back in the second segment. We're going to talk. I'm going to ask you the question I was going to ask you, but after we talk to Bill Daly. So don't, I know you're excited now. You're wondering what I'm going to ask you, but I'm going to tell you after we get done our conversation with Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly, which will come up shortly after we return with the second segment of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. As promised, back with the second segment, Two Man Advantage, the podcast. And again, as promised, Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly joining us. Bill, just before we start, normally, when Pierre tells me that he wants you to come and join us for one of these things, I assume it's to talk about the Miami Dolphins and the Dallas Cowboys and which team is worse, and you guys can share your misery. But we're going to talk hockey here. But just in case you want to get anything off your chest about either the Dolphins or the Cowboys to start, the floor is yours.
No, let's stay away from that topic. I think Pierre probably shares my view.
Yes, me too, especially after my team just panicked and traded away a first-round pick. So, yeah, let's stick to hockey.
All right, well, let's stick to actually the news of the day. And literally seconds before you joined us on Two Man Advantage, the league released its decision on Tom Wilson's appeal of his 20-game suspension, and the commissioners upheld that 20-game suspension for his preseason hit. And what kind of message do you – I mean, is this a message, Bill, that you think is particular to Tom Wilson, who's struggled to find a way to stay with inside the lines? Or is there a broader message you think that upholding the 20 game suspension sends, or what's your take on this?
Well, I would hope on some levels it's both. Obviously, Tom was in a situation that, you know, we haven't found ourselves in a lot over, you know, my time at the National Hockey League, where he had a number of, you know, incidents that were worthy of supplemental discipline. And the Department of Player Safety, to their credit, has spent a lot of time with Tom, a lot of time that was not even publicized, really going over, you know, the way he plays the game, things he can do to, you know, put himself in a better position to avoid discipline, including as recently as August of this year. And for Tom to have committed another rule violation, serious rule violation with a Rule 48 hit to the head, illegal check to the head, as soon after kind of his last skull session with the Department of Player Safety was concerning on a number of levels. So, you know, I think in situations where a player repeatedly violates the rule, and this is right out of the collective bargaining agreement, you know, the kind of the multiplier effect on what his level of suspension should be and what's fair certainly increases. And that was certainly the case in Tom's situation.
And now, Bill, I guess this is so fresh that you haven't heard from the NHLPA yet, but it's certainly within Wilson's CBA rights now to move this along through the PA to a neutral arbitrator. And you just had this process, although for a case that was obviously completely different in terms of Austin Watson, and the arbitrator in that case did reduce the league's original suspension, which I know disappointed the league based on the statement you guys put out. But maybe if you can walk us through again what the next step might be here and how long you think it'll be before you hear back from the PA on that.
Yeah, in fairness, I did reach out, as I typically try to do, in advance of us issuing the decision to give the Players Association a heads up that it was coming. Likewise, the commissioner reached out and spoke, I know, to Brian McClellan and to Tom Wilson directly to inform them directly of his opinion. So, you know, we certainly want to be upfront about it. You know, I you know, I asked the Players Association, you know, the commissioner's decision is somewhat lengthy. It's 31 pages. The Players Association and Tom had raised a number of arguments in the appeal hearing. And I think the commissioner's decision tries to address each and every one of those arguments. So, you know, the way I left it with the Players Association is after they've had a chance to review that opinion, and we should get back on the phone, and certainly we can talk at that point about which way they're leaning with respect to a potential appeal to an impartial arbitrator. You know, I won't presuppose the conclusion there, but you're quite right, Pierre. They do have that right, and I would expect in the next 48 hours, at a minimum, we'll know which direction this is going.
Great. Bill, I know Pierre has some questions, but before he gets to them, I wanted to slide this one in. It made me think of it because he and I actually went head-to-head in our football fantasy league last weekend. And normally we have a side bet, but he refused to bet last week with me and then, of course, ended up beating Craig Custance and I, so which is neither here nor there. But it made me think of some of the changes that across the sports betting landscape in recent months, and certainly going back to the expansion to Las Vegas. And I wonder if you've noticed since you know, sports betting has become legalized in different states now, do you see an impact on the NHL in terms of whether it's interest, do you track the way the betting patterns are going vis-a-vis hockey? Is there any way to connect the dots, whether there is, you know, it's a good thing for the NHL if the betting world is opened up as it is being gradually more accessible to more people? What's your view on that?
Well, I think there, you know, to your point, I think the landscape clearly is changed, and it's changed fairly dramatically. Having said that, I don't think the world has changed to this point all that dramatically. I think that's going to be an evolving process. You know, currently there's really only two jurisdictions that our teams play in where sports betting is technically legal. Which is New Jersey, and obviously the Devils just announced a partnership either today or yesterday with William Hill, which is a, you know, a world-renowned sports book, in Las Vegas, where sports betting has been legal for quite some time now. So it really has not yet impacted a large number of our clubs. I do expect that landscape, you know, obviously with the Supreme Court's decision, which was issued in April, each state is authorized to kind of make its own decision now, and certainly can authorize sports betting in whatever kind of format they want to do it. And that I fully expect a lot of states will go in that direction, and that may change our landscape more dramatically. So it's just a different reality we're dealing with. Certainly there are opportunities, financial opportunities associated with the new reality. Certainly there are, people have always suggested that, sports betting could be a way to enhance interest in the sport. I think it's too early for us to make any conclusions in that regard, but obviously we'll be anxious to monitor that and see if that plays out. So while this may not have been the world we necessarily advocated for, it is a world that we live in currently, and to the extent there are possibilities to take advantage of it from a league standpoint and a club standpoint, we'll certainly pursue those.
Bill, if I can shift gears to potential expansion to Seattle, when we last approached this at the Board of Governors meeting, the quick one-day meeting in early October in New York, and the commissioner announced essentially the go-ahead to proceed, to go to the next step in this. And I'm just wondering if there's anything new and what your expectation is for the big Board of Governors meeting in early December as far as Seattle.
No, I don't think there's anything new to report from the November or the early October Board of Governors meeting. We're progressing along the lines that we suggested we would. We are working on a report to the full Board of Governors, which we will vet with the executive committee. Ultimately, it'll be the executive committee's report to the full Board of Governors. Mm-hmm. That would recommend approval of the expansion application. We have a meetings, our December meetings, I think the 3rd and 4th of December, mm-hmm. In Seattle, Georgia. I would expect that at least unless anything changes between now and then, the Seattle expansion application will be a item on the agenda. We will give the board a full presentation, really outlining the report that will be have been included in their materials in advance. We'll take a motion and see if the application will be approved by the board. So we may have certainty in that regard, as much certainty as you can have at this point, by the end of the meetings on the 3rd and 4th of December.
And as a quick follow to that, Bill, would realignment, decision on realignment, is that the proper time for that at the same time? Or do you think, you can wait for another board meeting to tackle that?
Well, I would say it's a good question, Pierre, and I'm not sure I can give you a definitive answer at this point. I do expect that we will deal with realignment in the executive committee's report to the full board. So I think the vote that's going to occur on the 3rd and 4th will include realignment as an element of it. Certainly if that's the case, I would expect that that issue will be publicly made available, as a result of the vote.
But Bill, if I can just ask on the realignment, because it creates some obviously some interesting dynamics in how you go about it. Do you anticipate teams would lobby to go to a certain division? I mean, there's been some discussion. Could you at some point envision an all-Canadian division or a division in which all of the Canadian teams played together? And I know that there has been some suggestion. I think Commissioner Bettman was, sort of suggested that the realignment wouldn't be a dramatic overhaul, but is this an opportunity to sort of look at all possibilities with the potential of a 32nd team coming into the league?
Well, I think we're fairly far down that path in terms of what we're thinking on alignment. I think, as I said, I think the recommendation that has already been vetted with and adopted by the executive committee is firm at this point. To maybe expound on what Gary may have told you, I don't think we're looking at a dramatic realignment. I think we're looking at a tweak to the current alignment that is probably the most logical tweak we could make.
Right. So can I guess?
It's your show. You can guess.
I'm guessing Arizona moves from the Pacific to the Central, and Seattle just drops into the Pacific, and Bob's your uncle.
And what? What was the last point?
And Bob's your uncle.
And Bob's my uncle. That must be a saying.
It's a Hearst, Ontario saying, I think.
Okay. Very funny.
I didn't hear a response, though, to my guess.
No, that's what I said. I said you can guess. I'm not sure I can respond.
Okay. What about World Cup of Hockey, Bill? There was some. I know you got asked about it by European media during your time in overseas for the games that started the season. My understanding is that both the league and the PA want resolution, I guess, either way by the new year. Is there any developments there on World Cup?
I can't say that there are much in the way of new developments. I would say that we in the Players Association, continue to be focused on it, continue to have, discussions at a high level about it. But I don't think, I'm not sure there's been any real kind of working sessions yet toward that objective. That's I guess where I'd leave it. I certainly hope, and I think both parties intend to have more in-depth discussions on that in the near future. But I don't think there's anything scheduled as of today.
Bill, the time, it seems like it might be far away, but if you were going to hold to a four-year pattern and you would be looking at the fall of 2020, unless you dramatically changed and moved it into a mid-season type thing, which I don't think there's much appetite for from the ownership level, at least if I understand it. But when you think about what you would like to see, assuming that the World Cup of Hockey does maintain its pattern and we see it again. For instance, Craig and Pierre and I talked, was one podcast ago, I believe, but talking about Team North America and the excitement that they brought to the proceedings in Toronto in the fall of 2016. On a personal level, do you have a sense of what you'd like the tournament to look like in terms of the number of teams in the field? Would you like to see a return of a Team North America, tweaking, grandfathering maybe some players who already played in it so they could play with their nation countries? Or can you tell us or share what you feel personally would make for a good follow-up to the 2016 World Cup of Hockey?
Well, I think those are all details that absolutely will be discussed, as we go ahead with plans for the next World Cup, and they have to be discussed. I can't tell you that I have a definitive view on that. Certainly, I agree with your, suggestion and opinion that, there were certain elements of our last World Cup in 2016 that made, the Team North America and even to some extent Team Europe very exciting and compelling. In retrospect, I think it worked very, very well for the tournament. Whether those circumstances and dynamics will exist and continue to exist going forward and more specifically going forward in the next World Cup, I think is kind of yet to be seen. I think we said at the time in 2016, and I stay with the answer currently, I think, we do view this to be, a nation team competition. In a perfect world, our next World Cup would go in that direction, which would mean that we wouldn't have kind of a hybrid team either in Europe or North America. But I also don't know the circumstances under which we're going to be planning the next World Cup. And I think, you know, our talks with the Players Association over the next 2 months, 2.5 months, will go further to kind of refine our thinking in that regard.
Well, and Bill, it's going to be hard not to think CBA, even though, you know, you can have a World Cup decision independent of the CBA, of course, but you know, whenever you have these conversations with the NHLPA, I'm sure so much of it overlaps, right, in terms of, you know, the vision that both sides have for international hockey and international calendar and all those things. Do you think there's any chance that coming out of a World Cup decision, especially if it's a positive one, that there could be more clarity on where things are headed with the CBA in terms of the reopener decision next fall and beyond?
I would definitely agree that the subjects are intertwined. So, you know, as much as we want to be focused on our ability to plan the next World Cup, our ability to plan the next World Cup is necessarily related to, you know, what the situation is with the collective bargaining agreement and the expiration date, and, you know, a negotiation of an extension or a new collective bargaining agreement. So I think all those issues that you raise fairly are to some extent intertwined, you know, and I don't have a crystal ball right now with respect to how that all plays out, but it's certainly part of the same discussion.
So I don't know if this matters, but I know Pierre and I have taken a vote and we're against a work stoppage. So that if you want to. You wanted to add that to that.
You know what? I'm not a big fan of work stoppages either.
I know you're probably going to yell at me, but I tweeted this in September, Bill, and I really do believe it. But I find this, and this is a separate matter, but I find the use of preseason, the importance of preseason to me has changed so much over the years because of how players show up to camp in much better shape than they used to. So I think the preseason's too long. I know it's actually been shortened during your time than from what it was before, but is there any appetite to, and I know preseason games means revenue for both the players and the owners, but is there any appetite whatsoever? And I know I live in my naive world, but to start the season earlier and end it earlier?
Well, I mean, two different. I can either answer your question directly, which was a little bit different than the question you started with
okay,
the scenario season, or I can try to address both. You know, I'll certainly concur with your opinion with respect to preseason and how it's changed over the years and the relevance of the preseason and the utility of the preseason and what the preseason may look like going forward. And we've had, you know, we probably had more of those discussions in 2012 negotiation than we did in 2004, although it was the 2004 negotiation where we shortened training camp. But I think, you know, I definitely think those will be issues that are on the table again when we next bargain with the players. And I, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not sure. We may have pretty good alignment on what to do with the preseason and how long it should be and how many games it should be and how it should be structured into the overall business. So I agree with you. I think it's definitely a subject that needs to be explored and discussed. I don't know what the answers are to it quite yet. And, you know, whatever those answers are, we have to kind of reach jointly with the Players Association, so I'm not going to presume what the answer is. But I agree. I think times have changed and continue to change. And, you know, at least we have to be cognizant of that fact and you know, and respond to it in some way. So that would be my answer to kind of your first musing. With respect to kind of starting the season earlier and ending the season earlier, I would say that, and certainly that's a topic that's gotten a lot of conversation over my tenure in the National Hockey League. I think there's general agreement that if we could end the playoffs earlier, that would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think at all there's alignment or agreement that the way to do that is to start the season earlier. I think there are a number of teams in our league who would be very much opposed to starting the season earlier, because I don't think they feel like it maximizes, you know, the early, you know, the September games and early October games don't maximize their ability to sell tickets, and, you know, and tickets are still an important part of our business. So if clubs aren't comfortable that games in September are going to sell as well as games in, you know, the middle of October or the middle of November, then that's something we have to be cognizant of. So, you know, it's a complicated question.
All right, Bill, before I allow Pierre to harangue you on changing the start date for free agency, which is, of course, long been known as the LeBron proposal, I am going to allow you to escape without having to deal with that. But I wanted to thank you on behalf of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. Thanks for dropping by and spending some time with us. It's always fun to catch up. So really appreciate it.
Always happy to talk to you guys. Appreciate the support and the support of the game. It's all good.
All right, that was great, and I'll give you full credit, Pierre. That was your idea to have Bill on, and it's always great to catch up. And I think he did appreciate not having to go through your perpetual desire to have free agency before the Canadian summer holiday on July 1st. So,
well, it's not just that. I mean, at least he answered the other part, which, I mean, I just don't think there should be any hockey played past May 31st. I think the Stanley Cup should be awarded by May 31st. There should not be hockey in June, but the deputy commissioner knows that because I've complained about it for a long time.
All right, before we close out, the one thing I want to raise this with you, really, I came across it just before we started to tape today, and I'm sure you're aware that the hockey song by Stompin' Tom Connors is going to be inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame. I didn't even know there was a Hall of Fame. I didn't know there was a ceremony, but apparently at Saturday's game between Toronto and the Winnipeg Jets, the hockey song, which is a terrific piece of music by a Canadian musical icon, will be so inducted. And before we close today, I want to know what's your favorite hockey song? Is there?
It would be Fireworks from the Tragic
Hit. Yes.
The opening line about, the goal we all remember in 72. And now I'm wondering if I'm allowed to quote the line now. It is an Athletic podcast.
It is. I think you can say it.
Yeah. And of course, the line goes, you said you didn't give a fuck about hockey, and I never saw someone ever say that before. And course, if you're a fan of the Tragically Hip, and certainly if you're Canadian, that's one of the great lines ever. You were loosening my grip on Bobby Orr.
Great. Yes. Song. Yeah, no, great song. I mean, it's funny. I went back and I was
and it's
thinking,
actually not really a hockey song. After that, it's more a song about relationships and everything else. But great song, awesome.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Well, it's good. Well, I'm looking forward to. And I actually was in the Air Canada Centre one night, when Stompin' Tom Connors actually played the hockey song live between periods on one of the concourses. Do you remember that? I think you were there with me. But so I've actually seen him play that live. So I'm glad we got to touch on this before we close out this edition of Human Advantage. So good job. Anything
fun,
else?
Fun podcast, my friend. Trade me Zeke Elliott. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll talk about that next week. Thanks very much.